Today we're going to have a little bit of an introduction and look at one of my favourite characters in the Bible. And if we have time, we'll interact with another person in Genesis, a woman in Genesis. And the next two studies, we're going to look at Lot's wife, Eve, and Rebecca, and the question of their wrong focus. And then also in a further study, we're going to look at the whole question of the women of Genesis and the abuse and the rejection that they have known in their lives, and how that is a strategic part of the recording of the Genesis story. I personally love doing theology by the way that Paul Tillich tells us to do it, and I'm not a great fan of Paul Tillich in any other way, but in this particular way, that he says that to do theology we really need to understand that we have two poles. One pole is our authority, for us the Bible, and the other pole is all the questions that are being asked in the world and the community in which we live. And to do theology and to do our Bible study in a way that penetrates our culture, we have to hear our world, understand our world, and be able to take our Bible and interact it in that world in which we live. That's the commitment that I have as a theological lecturer. For example, my students are asked to comment on Bart Simpson's understanding of providence, as you see every night on Channel 10, and certainly in New South Wales at 6 o'clock, because Bart Simpson is full of contemporary theology which our people and our young people are watching and asking questions of. And I would say that as we look at our society today, the big question that is being asked is the role of women, our understanding of the role of women in our society and our community. And for us, I suggest that what we need to do is make sure that we apply the word to that question that is being asked. A couple of years ago, I had the privilege of doing some postgraduate work under Barbara Thiering, that some of you might know from her book, Jesus the Man. Barbara's quite a character, and Barbara and I had many interesting discussions over the reliability of the Gospels and everything else, and I'll never forget her discussion of the resurrection of Christ, because of course she believes that the Gospels are basically reliable, all written by 44, but Jesus never rose. He was actually just in this tomb with the two thieves on the cross, and one of them was Simon Magnus, and Mary Magdalene somehow got through the roof of the tomb and came in, and Simon Magnus used to be a medico man, and so together with Mary Magdalene they took the aloes and whatever, and they revived Jesus, and Jesus got up, and Simon Magnus with a broken leg and the other thief with a broken leg, the three of them got up and they knocked away the stone and they went out and claimed resurrection. That's what Barbara Thiering believes. I was trying to tell her that's a bigger miracle than what the Gospels record themselves. So Barbara and I had some interesting discussions, but one thing she did really encourage me to do is to look at how we as a church and as a denomination, as Baptists, have viewed women in our life. Now, by doing this, I am not moving into a feminist tirade or a call for ordination of women or whatever. That's for other places and for other situations. I think what Barbara was saying to me, and I think is most appropriate, is to ask, to what extent have we recorded and listened to the journey of women in our histories? And I would suggest to you, as Baptists, we've done very little listening to the journeys of women in our histories. In fact, Dr. Heather Boats, of course, is now with the Lord, has herself said that the Australian religious history, Baptist religious history, is basically a clerical, patriarchal story. Clerical, patriarchal story. Therefore, the history of Baptist women has basically not been heard. Now, the interesting thing, of course, if you go to the Australian Baptist, and by the way, this is not a critique on the Australian Baptist, if you go through the pages of the Australian Baptist, you'll find that it has a very balanced recording of the role of women over many years, and it faithfully just records what people are saying, but it's one of the good ways of discovering how we've understood women. And I would suggest to you that over the years we've really treated women and their stories as non-persons. As non-persons. Listen, for example, at this article in 1925. It was written by another woman to a minister's wife, but it could have been written to any particular woman. And it's interesting that it's a woman that is actually writing this article that shows that sometimes the treating of non-persons has actually come from the female side itself. This lady writes, "Mrs. Minister, think of your husband as a representative of Jesus Christ, the messenger of God. What a privilege it is to be a helpmate, side companion, to be a messenger of the holy or powerful God, to stand by his side and to help spread tidings of joy to a perishing world. When you witness your husband uniting two people in marriage, you have an opportunity of showing the young bride and groom how God will help them meet the tests of life. What a golden opportunity you have of taking the bride in your arms and giving motherly hints on the sacred steps she has taken. What a reward it is to come home after an afternoon's visiting among the members to find on the doorstep a gift of fruit or vegetables from someone's garden. The gift may be small, but when you think of the love that prompted that member of your congregation to leave it there, it should melt you with gratitude. It should make you feel utterly unworthy such love and thoughtfulness. Mrs. Minister, take that noble husband of yours to your heart and let him feel that you are sharing his burdens. You should be his inspiration. You should be his inspiration. All the noblest and best that is in him should come forth when he is in your presence. Now, Mrs. Minister, if you feel the burden of being a preacher's wife too heavy, you ought to be ashamed. You are bringing into disrepute the high calling of the ministry. You are trampling underfoot the precious blessings that are yours. If your husband is not going well in the pulpit, look at yourself. Perhaps you are a damper, a check on his fiery zeal for lost souls. Perhaps you are poisoning his spiritual food by your grumblings and complainings. God forbid that a preacher, a messenger of God, should have a buzzing bumblebee tied to him for life that will sting the spiritual vitality out of him. A non-person, simply there to fulfil the dreams and aspirations of her husband. And of course, if you think that's an extreme, I could point to other stories. For example, in 1988, there is an account of how a woman who is a leader in a society, in a rehabilitation unit, is doing all the sorts of things in a country town of New South Wales, an absolute leader that obviously the whole society comes to, and she's a profile of a Baptist woman. And when it comes to her role in the church, she teaches Sunday school as a secretary of the LA and supports her husband as a deacon. So she's making all the decisions out here. In there, she's simply someone who is doing the expected tasks and supporting her husband in the areas that she should. And it's also seen in our histories. And once again, I'm not trying to have a go at the people who have written histories, because they are also writing from their own time, and I'm sure if they are writing history now, would be aware of the situation. But of course, John G. Ridley is a man who's touched my life, and C.J. Tinsley are two of the most prominent Baptist clerics of this century. In Ridley's biography on his colleague Tinsley, much is said as Tinsley's soul, Church Stanmore. A chapter is headed, Stanmore and its Mighty Men. No reference of women at all. Or Dr. Basil Brown and his short history of the Baptist Union of Australia has a chapter, Let Us Now Praise Famous Men. Seven men are discussed and only one woman is mentioned in passing. And from the official history of the Baptist Union of New South Wales, some feel on good ground. It's an interesting book. It deals with some of the situations that happened in the early churches, including in Parramatta, where a woman was to keep silent right up until in meetings, right up until recent times. So you can see that that sort of understanding of women as non-persons has been very much part of our recording of our Baptist history. Of course, it's not the truth. Women have been significant players in our Baptist church life. I asked the Missionary Society a year or so ago how many women had been missionaries. I don't know why, someone could tell me, but they gave me a figure up to 1964. Up to 1964, they indicated 89 New South Wales women as against 42 New South Wales men had served as missionaries. 2 to 1. And in fact, at present, 24 women as against 19 men serve in this capacity. And many of you will know that the first baptisms in this country were two women who were baptised in Woolloomooloo Bay, and that's a story in itself if you get time to read it. It's a remarkable account as the papers sent it up and talked about this hilarious situation that was taking Woolloomooloo Bay. So our understanding of history has been that women themselves have played a significant part. Let me also say that as I prepared this study, my plea, if I can have any impact on people here, my plea is that we'll go away and we'll start doing the history of women in our churches. We'll start recording it. We'll start listening, whether it be at postgraduate level or whether it just be for our own benefit. But to do that, we're going to have to move quickly. We're going to have to move with tape recorder. We're going to have to find people and sit down and listen, because those who can tell us the history are quickly passing on. We're going to have to record afresh, because friends, on the whole, the story of women amongst us as people has not been recorded. The interesting thing is that when you come to the story of Genesis and the account of the Genesis, I think you find the same thing happening. Genesis, of course, when you look at Bible studies on Genesis, you hear a lot about Abraham, Jacob, Isaac, Joseph, etc., all being championed, and their cause being set forth, and commentaries and devotions are full of the stories of these men, and rightly so. One very good biblical text heads its Genesis studies, the fathers, or the patriarchs. But what about the women and the sisters? Because if you do read Genesis, particularly Genesis 12 to 50, you'll discover that the story of women is just as rich in those chapters as the story of men. Remarkable accounts of the deeds of women, the role of women, the place they play, and also the trials and the burdens of women as seen with the trials and burdens of men. After I'd actually prepared this study, and I wish I'd found a little bit earlier, I came across a book called The Women of Genesis by Sharon Jensen, and some of you might have read it, The Women of Genesis. And she says herself this on page 117. The narratives of Genesis 12 to 50, the account of Israel's origins, are not simply the story of the patriarchs. Rather, the women of Genesis are seen as valuable contributors in this critical expression of Israel's self-understanding. They are valued as the mothers of a people who struggle to survive, as directors of their family's destiny, as the recipients of God's revelation, and as participants in the struggles for justice and self-identity as Israel defines itself in the context of its neighbours. I think it's time for us to hear the spiritual journey of women, whether it be in the book of Genesis or whether it be in our churches. And of course, sadly, I guess in some sense, it's a male who's got the privilege of perhaps taking us through that journey today. And of course, most of us would know that in the Gospels we see Jesus in his own way affirming the story of women and the journey of women. I think the most remarkable thing from my own perspective as a lawyer is that when I look at the ones who give the evidence, the unbroken chain of evidence from the death of Jesus to the burial of Jesus to the resurrection of Jesus, there is only one group of people who give that unbroken chain of evidence. It's the women. And of course, in law, that's the chain of evidence that you would need. Seeing him die, seeing him buried, and seeing him rose again. It's the women. And as the Jewish historian Lapid says, that's actually extraordinary. Because women in those days weren't allowed to give evidence in a court of law. If you were going to fabricate something, then you would have guaranteed it wasn't women who did it. But the women were entrusted with telling the story in a reliable, legal, technical sense that he is risen. The journey of women. The spiritual journey of women. Today, I'd like us to look at Sarah. Just as before we do, let me say one thing about the way that women are used. For example, and we'll come to this in the either today or tomorrow, but if you look at Genesis 25 verses 19 to 27 later, Genesis 25, 19 to 27, this is probably known to all of you, but it hit me as I was doing this study, that Rebecca is the one who is given the statement about Jacob receiving the blessing and not Esau. Now I'm sure the women have all picked that up, but as a man I just assumed that that was known by her husband. But of course it wasn't. And in some sense, there's no indication that Isaac ever knew, and in some sense that could go on to explain these extraordinary events that then took place about, you know, Isaac being confused and being deceived about what took place. Because the actual revelation about the covenant and who had received the gift of the covenant and how the line would continue was given to Rebekah and not to Isaac. Just one situation, one incident of the role that women play in the Word of God, in the book of Genesis. So today I want to look at Sarah, and perhaps if we have time, interact with Hagar as we continue to see the women's journey. What I'm going to suggest is that we take time to read Genesis chapter 12. Do we all have Bibles, or can we all get a Bible to look on to? Is that a possibility? Is there anybody who hasn't got a Bible to look on with? Because we've got a spare Bible, we could get one to that person. I often think, particularly if we want to do a couple of long readings, it's nice if we do the reading ourselves from our own translation. What I would like you to do is just take a few moments now to read Genesis chapter 12, Genesis chapter 12, and then Genesis chapter 18, Genesis chapter 18, verses 1 to 15. Genesis 12 and Genesis 18, 1 to 15. Just to take time to read that on your by yourself, and perhaps you might like to mark some things that stand out as you read. Genesis 12, all of the chapter, and 18, 1 to 15. One of the things that has always struck me about Sarah is that she is a woman who appears to cope. Now, of course, most of us will know that Sarai and Abram don't get the name changed to Genesis 17, and Abram gets his name then changed to Abraham, father of many. And in the context of 16 beforehand, with respect to Hagar being given to Abraham, Sarah's maidservant, one would think that he's going to be the father of many through Hagar. But then, surprise, surprise, we find it's actually going to be through Sarah. And Sarah's name can be a play on princess, who's going to be actually the mother of the children of God. But we will take it as Abraham and Sarah from the beginning of our study. But that happens in Genesis chapter 17. She is a woman who copes remarkably in a number of areas, and we'll see in a moment. But the amazing thing is that she's particularly vulnerable in one area, and she doesn't cope at all. Let's look at the ways that Sarah copes. So I think the story of Sarah is a story of a journey of someone who copes with the real struggles of life, but deep down there's an area where she's particularly vulnerable, like most of us. And she has to be reminded she can only pass that one relying upon the Lord. It's a message for us all. Look at the way that she coped. For example, she travelled from Ur over to Palestine with her husband. Now, that's great coping. I mean, people will tell you that one of the most stressful things that we can know in life is moving. And Alvin Toffler in Future Shock talks about mobility. We live in an age of mobility. We're always on the move. We're going from one community to another. And because of that, there's new faces in the supermarket, new neighbours. We're a community that knows great loneliness because of our moving. Well, Sarah herself knew that. She moved from one side of the world, literally, to another side of the world in her day. She went with her man. She was a person who coped with the great struggle of moving great distances. She also coped with a man who failed her badly. Genesis 12 is a real warts and all character study of this guy, Abraham. He failed Sarah badly. They're in Egypt, famine. They're wanting food. And of course, what Abraham is doing, protecting his own skin, he decides to pass Sarah off as his sister. And the amazing thing is, if you look at Genesis chapter 20, because he does it again, if you look at Genesis chapter 20, you'll see that he says that they made an agreement that they would do that. That would be that would be something that would take place on their journey. He'd even lined Sarah up for this. He says in verse 13, listen to this. And I said to her, to Sarah, this is how you can show your love to me. Everywhere we go, say of me, here is my brother. What a louse. Listen here, powerless one, this is how you show your love and affection for me. Wherever you go, and I'm in trouble, I'm your brother. What does that mean for her? She gets put in adulterous situations. She gets put with Pharaoh and another guy who themselves become victims of Abraham's lack of strength, where she herself is not only, I dare say, vulnerable to sexual abuse, she's vulnerable to all sorts of physical abuse that might happen as a result of that. If you go back to Genesis chapter 12, you'll see that Abraham is really quite scared stiff. You'll see in these verses, and I think the narrator is making it very clear, when he says, when the Egyptians see you, they will say, this is his wife. She's just a material object. This is his wife. The narrator's playing this story beautifully. They will kill me. Better translation is slay. Has a sense of brutality. Abraham is really fearful of what these people might do to him. So he passes his object, this is his wife, off as his sister. And of course, most of us will know that in the relationship with the Pharaoh, there is discussion as to whether sexual intercourse took place. We don't really know, but verse 19 would indicate perhaps that it didn't. Pharaoh says, I took her to be my wife. And if sexual intercourse had taken place, one would assume that the writer would have written, he went into her. So perhaps no sexual intercourse, but certainly Pharaoh took this woman and put her in an adulterous situation to protect Abraham. And Pharaoh himself got ill as a result, so any particular situation could have happened to them both. And in Genesis 20, he does it again. This time with Abimelech. And of course, Abimelech also comes under God's wrath, and again he trades Sarah off as his sister to protect his own skin. And he suggests in verse 12, and this could be true, that Sarah was his half-sister. And I think there's actually a hint of this in Genesis 11, verses 27 to 32. And you can look at that later. But in verse 11, he said, verse 12, but she really is my sister, the daughter of my father, though not of my mother, and she became my wife. And we know from those days that there were wife-sister relationships that were held in honour, and it was possible at times, it appears, that for a wife actually to be adopted in some form as a sister. So there might be some truth to that story. Perhaps Abraham there, and it's just narration, it's not the inspired word of God here, just narrating quickly what Abraham said. Abraham could have well been telling the truth. This was his half-sister. But it still doesn't condone his action, does it? Because he was his wife. That's what he was hiding to all and sundry, to protect his own skin. And as a consequence, as I say, she gets into trouble sexually in a situation where she could be abused, and of course the two men that take Sarah themselves get under the wrath of God. And of course he sets a pattern, because the most remarkable thing is that when you get to Genesis chapter 26, Isaac does exactly the same thing. His son follows his father's behaviour pattern and does exactly the same thing with his wife. And one of the amazing things that come out of the story is you look at how Pharaoh responds in Genesis 12, and you'll see that Pharaoh actually comes across as the moral person. I mean, how dare you do this? Here's a pagan seeming to be more moral than the great man of God, Abraham, who's trading off his sister. And God is clearly anti all of this. His wrath is on the whole proceedings, clearly seen in Genesis 12 and 20. He is not condoning Abraham's action. And I guess there's truth of that for many of us, that often those who seem to be the most pious and the moral crusaders are actually less pious and moral than the community out there. Sometimes we protest too much. Did Abraham love Sarah? I believe so. Genesis chapter 23 brings this out. In verses 1 and 2, you'll see that Sarah died to be 127 years old. That's important. She's the only woman whose age is recorded in those 12 to 50 chapters. And look at the age, 127, right up there with Abraham, 175, and Jacob, 147, showing that she's a woman of great stature. And you see there in verse 2 that Abraham wept for her. But the other interesting thing, if you read the story of Genesis 23, and I'm sure most of you have, and the death of Sarah, you'll find that, of course, Abraham buys a burial site, doesn't he? From the Hittites. And that's remarkable in itself, because that gives them a leg into the Hebron area. And he actually goes through the whole process of buying it. And it's actually through the death of Sarah that the first legal purchase of land in the promised land comes to fruition. Her death is actually sealed with the first purchase of land in the promised land. So she's seen there as an extremely significant person, with the promise now clearly being fulfilled in Sarah's death that was given to Abraham. And friends, I would like to suggest that many women know men who have failed them. And of course, this is becoming more apparent as we look at the journeys of women over the last few years. Relatives, fathers, husbands, priests, pastors, leading lay people who have failed them sexually and in other areas. It's a story the church cannot hide any longer. Many women know men who have failed them, but they've also known husbands who have failed them. I mean, I failed my wife so many times I can't keep count. I mean, I try to be one of these snags. I mean, she's got to be out there working, she's studying, she's doing law, she works at the same time. I mean, like many women today, they work because they want to, you know, find some fulfillment for themselves. They find in their work, and if they want to stay at home and have kids, that's fine. You know, they make whatever decision suits them. Of course, they want to buy a house of any means, and you find the wife working as well. The husband tries to be a snag, but most of it's words, and you know, the wife still ends up, as all the surveys are doing, saying, still doing basically two jobs, working and running the house. And that whole expectation with respect to her man often has a sense of failure. But friends, it's not only women who know failure from significant others. Many of us here today know what it is to be failed by significant others in our lives. And I think that's the most hurtful thing that can happen to anybody. To be let down by someone in employment or in church or family or member, a significant other who fails you. Sarah coped with that. She also coped with family division, which you can read in Genesis chapter 13. Lot, of course, Abraham's nephew, and Abraham split and go their separate ways, and she copes with all of that. So she copes with moving, she copes with a male who fails her, she copes with division in the family, but there is one thing that she doesn't cope with. One area that she's particularly vulnerable, and that is in her area of barrenness. She wants a child. And of course, I mean, in those days, I mean, to not have a child would be not to fill her own womanhood. And she wanted a child. Now, we don't know whether she was ever made aware of the promise given to Abraham in Genesis chapter 12, Genesis chapter 15, and Genesis chapter 17. We're not made aware if Abraham actually told Sarah about the promise that through Sarah, particularly in Genesis 17, that he would have a great nation. We assume that took place, but we don't know. My own personal reflection is certainly at Genesis 17, because it's a very personal account where God talks to Abraham about Sarah, that one would expect that Sarah would be aware of that. But even if Sarah was not aware of that, it's very evident that she wanted a child, which is understandable, to fulfil her role as seen in society. And that's the area she didn't cope. Look at chapter 16. What did she do? She trades off her maidservant, goes into surrogate motherhood in order to have a child through her maidservant, Hagar. And did you see the way that she doesn't cope? We read in verse 6 of chapter 16 that she mistreats Hagar. And then you go on to chapter 20, isn't it, or 21, where she actually sends Hagar out into the wild. This woman, who seems to be coping in so many areas, is not coping with that area which is particularly vulnerable, even up to the way of mistreating Hagar herself. And I would suggest that all of us have areas in our life where we are vulnerable. All of us have areas in our life where we do not cope, where we need the touch of the Lord. This really comes out in Genesis chapter 18, which is one of the great stories. The three visitors appear to Abraham. Many of you will know it well. In verse 1, Abraham seems to be having a appearance. God appears before Abraham, and then in verse 2, you find out there are three men standing nearby, and they have a meal with Abraham, and God appears to be amongst the three. And the scholars say it's the most remarkable thing. It's the only reference in the Old Testament that God actually sits down and has a meal with somebody. And it's a story that has a ring of truth. Abraham feeds them but stands aside, which of course would have happened in those days. If guests turned up, you fed the guests, but you stood aside so you could wait on their every need. So this has a real ring of truth about it. Who are the three men? I mean, is God one of these three men? I mean, what's going on here? Well, if you look at chapter 19, you'll see that clearly two are angels. Two go down to Sodom. So out of the three, two go down to Sodom and are angels. Now, some of us might have difficulty talking about angels today, because we might think that's all that sophisticated and modern 20th century. Folks, let me tell you that angels are the end thing. Don't apologise for angels. I've spent half my life in the New Age movement at the moment. I can tell you the biggest thing as you minister to New Age people is angels. They're into them. The biggest book selling are angels. Angelology, they love it. You come down to the Mind Body Spirit Festival with me at Darling Harbour. We run our Christian store, and you'll find that there's angel seminars going on, and they are booked out. Go down to Dimmicks and other places, you'll find angels. I say to my theological students, the things you've got to preach on at Christmas are angels. Letterbox drop and say you're going to be preaching on angels. Half the church will stay away thinking you're loony loon, but all the neighbourhood will come in. I'm preaching now with Brian Willistoff on a number of occasions at Cherrybrook. And so they put me to the test and said, OK, you do one of your sermons on angels. And I thought, oh, it sounded good at the time. And I stood up to preach. I thought, oh, what am I talking about here? Talking about angels. And I really felt it, though. All these people out there talking about angels. The reaction afterwards was absolutely amazing. Absolutely amazing. As people came out of the woodwork and just wanted to talk. Don't apologise for angels today. Andrew Greeley, that great sociologist, says that he finds it interesting that as people have dismissed angels because it doesn't fit in their worldview, they've taken up with science fiction like Star Wars and all the rest. And he reckons it's the theological sophisticated replacement for what's inherent in all of us. So, the angels go down to Sodom. Who is the third person? Well, of course, you'll find that many would say that the third person is God himself, God the Father. Well, I don't believe that. I believe the scripture makes it very clear that God the Father is spirit. Others will say to us, and I think quite rightly, that the third person is another angel, another messenger of God, however we want to describe it. And Abraham, from verse 1, associates this person as speaking on God's behalf when we get to verse 2, and I think that's quite acceptable. The word Lord there in verse 3 can just be a term of respect. So this person is God's mouthpiece. And of course others, some of you might be in this category, believe that no, the third person is the pre-incarnation of Christ. I think Billy Graham holds that. And one of the reasons I think he would say that is you find that word my Lord in some of the old manuscripts is O Lord, and they would say that most occasions the Old Testament when O Lord is used, it's a reference to God. So it can't be God the Father, so it's God the Son. So the two major views amongst the evangelicals is this is a messenger of God. Abraham particularly sees this third person as a messenger of God speaking on behalf of God, and others would see this person as the pre-incarnated Christ. Anyway, this third person is speaking to Abraham. But of course the story is not about Abraham, is it, in Genesis chapter 18? It's about Sarah. And it's a marvellous account. And what comes up is that the person with Sarah clearly listening, this person says, you know that thing that Sarah's really dependent upon me for? You know that area that Sarah's really vulnerable? It's going to happen this year. It's going to happen. She's going to have a child. Now, Sarah's hearing this, and of course she laughs. Why does she laugh? Well, possibly it's the first time she'd actually heard the promise, if Abraham hadn't told her. I thought, oh, this is ridiculous. I think that she probably had understood the promises received to Abraham, but I mean, you know, this woman's approaching 90 and it's a cynical laughter of doubt. But she laughs. And in fact, the cynicism is seen in her central comment about, am I really going to have pleasure with this man now? What a cynical response. I mean, now I'm in the 90s, this is when I'm going to have my pleasurable experience. A sensual comment. But she hears. And then comes that remarkable statement, is anything too hard for the Lord? And Sarah pretends that she wasn't laughing. The interesting thing is that if you look at the story of Hagar, you'll find that Hagar herself does exactly the same. Hagar herself in the area that she is most vulnerable in with respect to her child, and the nation from her child herself gives up in despair. For example, if you look at Genesis chapter 16, you'll see that Hagar, verse 10, sorry, 16 verse 10, you'll see that the angel added to Hagar, your descendants will be so great, so numerous that you won't be able to count them. But when you go over to Genesis chapter 21, and we'll look at this in the next couple of weeks, the next couple of days, when you go over to Genesis chapter 1, verse 16, what happens with Hagar? She's been put out there. There's no food, no water. She's really struggling with her son. You know the story of Not. We'll come to it in the next couple of days. Then she went off and sat down nearby about a bowshot away, which she thought, I cannot watch the boy die. And as she sat there nearby, she began to sob. So she had been given the promise from God that she would have a child and she'd have many descendants in a great nation. But when the pressure came, she herself, like Sarah, was vulnerable on that promise and doubted. and didn't have the strength to believe. By the way, that shows you the extent of what Sarah did when you look at that pain that came in Hagar through Sarah's actions herself. So warts and all, friends, Sarah, a woman who coped, but not coping in the area that she was most vulnerable. Let me ask you, what area are you most vulnerable in, as I ask myself? And are we coping in that area? Perhaps it's something in our life that we've allowed to control us. The word sin is not popular today. But something that has continued to control us and we've never been able to let go. Perhaps it's a hurt from a significant other that just consumes us and we've never released it. Perhaps it's our unemployment. Perhaps it's our despair about, why aren't people listening to the stories of women in our churches? Perhaps it is something that's happened to you in the life of the church. What are you most vulnerable in? As I was driving down today from the Sunshine Coast, thinking about this morning, the Lord convicted me again about the area that I know I'm most vulnerable in. And again said to me, Ross, is anything too hard for the Lord? How do you hand that area over? Well, you know, I'm not playing down the role of professional counselling or whatever, but I think today we're seeing a movement back to basics. That the way that we restore our life is basically in basic moves. Look at the best-selling books, All I Really Need to Know I Learned in Kindergarten. Life's Little Instruction Book. People are moving to basic understandings of how to change your life. That's why the Rick Warren and all these how-to things that I find myself doing all the time these days are so successful. People are convinced about the basics. I must tell you, it's quite disturbing. I was preaching at Cherrybrook the other day and this woman came up to me and she said, oh, I really enjoy your preaching. It was how to do something, rather, it was a sermon. She said, I was saying to my friends, I want to come and hear you, that you really touched my spot. Mind you, she said, I told them, you're not very deep. Oh, no. The old legacy of the how-to sermons, Well, let me just suggest four basic steps. You acknowledge your vulnerability. You acknowledge an area in your life that you are vulnerable and you're totally dependent upon God for. You find His promise to you, as Sarah did. For her, it was a child that it would come. For us, it might be peace, strength to overcome, healing, forgiveness, guidance. So we acknowledge our vulnerability. We find God's promise for us in the Word. We give the Lord space, to let that be fulfilled in our life. And I think one of the reasons that happens as you look at the story of Genesis, that life is really about the valleys, not about the mountain peaks, isn't it? It really is about the valley experiences. That's what the how-to sermons are all about, how to handle the valley experiences of life. I remember Chuck Swindoll saying, and he's one, I think, of the great how-to preachers, saying that he always preaches on trouble spots in people's lives, because on any one Sunday he can guarantee 75 to 80% of people that are sitting in his church have got a problem. Only 20% are probably riding high. And then in faith, you claim or you allow the Lord to touch that area of vulnerability and allow Him to move you from that. And of course that's what Hebrews 11:11, I think, is the correct translation. It says that Sarah, by faith, had Isaac. She realised where she was vulnerable. She knew what the promise of God was. She allowed God to touch her life, and by faith she turned it around. Jack Gibson is one of the great football coaches in New South Wales. Some of you might know him. One of the greatest. And he was talking at a sports and leisure function. That's the group that put chaplains in professional sport. Jack received an award from us. And I'll never forget, he said, I have 10 minutes at half time. And he said, I've got 10 minutes to speak here. Let me tell you what I do in half time. For 9.5 minutes, I say nothing. Then as the players run out on the field, he says, I say to them, fellas, do you think you can run a little bit faster? Tackle a little bit harder? That's it. That's the end of my half time speech. The greatest rugby league coach of all time. Basics. And in Genesis 21:16, we see that when Isaac was born, there was laughter again. Isaac means he laughs. It's not cynicism now, but rejoicing in the provision of God. God who had taken her through the tough times. And we need to know that we can trust the Lord, even in those areas that we are vulnerable. And you know, trusting the Lord is hard. I had the privilege of just being over at Russia again in June or July. And I'm listening to Aeroflot travelling down. Aeroflot are trying to fix up their airline, and they need to do something because another plane has just crashed in Siberia, I think, and 120 people have died. Have you ever travelled Aeroflot domestically? Some of you might have heard the story. This last travel trip I took, I had a couple of members of Parliament with me from New South Wales, and we're travelling from Gomel to Moscow. And this is sort of, you know, from one republic to the other, but it's basically domestic travel. And you really need to trust. Because as you're walking out to the plane, you find that people are walking out with you with dogs. You think, this is amazing. And you go up the gangplank and you go in the passenger thing, and the people come in with their poodles, and they're sitting next to you with your poodles. You think, oh, this is amazing. And the next thing that happens, though, is a guy comes up with what looked like a bull terrier. And he's trying to get into the passenger seat and put his dog down, but they wouldn't let him. They stopped him and they took the dog off him, sat him down, took the dog off him, and went over to see what was the captain's cockpit, opened the door, kicked the dog in there and slammed the door shut. So this great big bull terrier became our co-pilot. And we're sitting here with poodles all around us, and these two guys arrived late, and this is being translated for us. They said, there's no seats left, it's a flying bus, you just all run on and get whatever seats you can. No seats left, and they said, oh, that's okay, we'll travel in baggage. And these two guys went down and stood in baggage the whole trip. And when we actually got off the plane, they were already on the tarmac because they jumped out. There's no seatbelts. They had to stand in baggage the whole trip. And then this woman came down, and from my previous experience, she brought down this little thing to drink. And it's just a plastic cup that's sort of got this fizzy drink in it. And my experience is you don't touch this stuff. From past experience, that's all you get in your flight. No food, just that. And she came down and offered it to us. And I looked at her and... from my experience replying on behalf of us all, I said, no, thank you. And she looked down at me and winked and said, smart move. Smart move. I can tell you, you've got to trust the travel in Russia. But let me tell you about, in Gomel, Igor. Igor and Vera, his wife. Igor lectures in the university. He has no academic training. He takes religious studies. This is a mainstream university, University of Gomel. He's on the street corner handing out tracts. He's running a church service in the Gomel jail, the largest jail in the country. Amazing church service. The jail has known renewal. To earn living at the same time, he sweeps the streets in order to survive. He's got no money. And his wife was six months pregnant when we arrived. And in order to support Igor, she was working as a cleaner 5 days a week to make $5 a month. $5 a month. And they had total trust in the Lord's provision for them. I don't think I could preach this sermon there. We need to know what it is to trust the Lord in the area that we're vulnerable. Mary Eason has been much in the news. Many of you know that she's the elected MP for Lowe recently. And she is, I think, was at least as prominent as Senator Bishop. And Mary Eason, who's a Labor Party member, said in the Sydney Morning Herald on the 8th of April 1993 about what Easter meant to her. This is what Mary Eason said, one who's going to the top in our federal politics. She said this, God has never let me down. I've been through some tough times, and it's my faith that has always pulled me through. In times of trouble, I get the solace I need, that sense that God will help me find a way through. It's the greatest gift I've got and the greatest gift I can give to my children. It's the greatest gift I've got and the greatest gift I can give to my children. All of us are vulnerable. All of us have weak spots. All of us have areas in our life where by faith we have to ask God to take us through. That's the journey of Sarah. All of us cope with so many things in life through our own strength and reliance upon God. We cope with so many things. But there's one or two things all our life or part of our life we don't cope with. The greatest gift that we can give to our children, the greatest gift we have, is by getting through those in faith and relying upon God. The Lord is saying to me today, as he's saying to you, is anything too hard for me? Is anything too hard for me? the story of Sarah and Hagar, women who coped but didn't cope. I'd suggest to you, it's a story of us all. Is anything too hard for me?